Welcome to the Illusion of More. If I'd known how hard it was to say that, I would have called the site something else. You know, I live in a pretty small community in the Hudson Valley in New York. And as 2012 was coming to a close, I thought it might be interesting to talk to someone who works in what we might consider the antithesis of the digital information age, and that's an editor-in-chief of a small-town newspaper. You know, with all the anonymous, frenetic, social and antisocial engagement regarding news on the internet, it's worth noting that there still are places where citizens can bump into the editor of their local paper on the street and tell him what they think right to his face. Perry Teasdale is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Columbia Paper, which is going into its fifth year. But he was also once part of a vanguard media movement himself back in the late 1960s and early 70s. That was when portable video cameras were first becoming available and affordable for regular people, and Perry was part of a collective that saw video for the common man as a democratizing force. He chronicled his experiences in his book called Video Freaks, that's Freaks with an X, America's first pirate TV station, and the Catskills Collective that turned it on. Perry and I got together at the Columbia Paper office and talked about journalism, video, and our relationship to information. Perry, welcome to the Illusion of More. So let me ask you right off the bat about running a small town paper in the digital age. Do you have a view on sort of the next generation and how it relates to news?
If you talk about social media in some sort of general terms, there are discussions there that address issues in the new that we consider older people, whoever we are, but that match a conventional definition of news. They're just discussed in a different way. So the processing of information is different, but it doesn't mean that the information isn't seeping in. Whether it's seeping in a way that's socially useful, given the social norms that we have, and given the governmental form that we have and our dependence on democracy for our lives and our livelihoods, that may be a real issue. And that is, I think it is a real issue. But I don't think that you can say that they're not getting news. I think you can say that they're not interested and they're not captive of the conventional news sources, being print, being television, being to a certain extent radio, that they're working with a different set of tools and they're processing and sharing information in different ways. That's very scary to the powers that be, but it doesn't mean that they're not engaged in the news in some way. They are not getting the same level of news that you'd get if you read the New York Times every day. Now, some young people do, but a large number don't, and probably fewer than used to do now. So you can make all those judgments, but you have to be very careful about what you define as getting the news and what the news is.
And do you yourself use social media?
No, I hate it.
No, why do you hate it?
Well, I come, it's generational, and I come from a time where privacy was valued for what it reserved rather than your lack of it or its absence. So I'm not comfortable still sharing information because it seems impolite, for one thing, as well as revealing in ways that I don't control. And it may be that that's a very unrealistic presumption that you could control it or that we ever did. But the new technologies that we're dealing with and the new applications of that technology make me uncomfortable, so I don't engage in it because it doesn't seem natural to me. I grew up with a different set of values about privacy and about even the definition that we make of ourselves, that we create for ourselves. And so that really is a generational gulf. And that's very hard to bridge. I think it's as hard as maybe, you know, accepting long hair was for parents, or just accepting that there might be a world other than network news sources.
I assume it's fair to say that your paper, considering the demographics of Columbia County, that your readership skews older.
No question about it.
So do you spend much time thinking about the future of local news with regard to the next generation who are growing up digital?
Do I ever not think about it? You know, the platform, the medium, whatever, the way, the manner in which the news is delivered is in some ways really tied to that, what that news is. But also, there are two different parts of the process, which is the gathering of the news, and then there's the dissemination. And I'm not as wedded to dissemination methods as I am to the gathering of it. I think the gathering is what excites me, and the way, finding ways to support the gathering of news, and what gets gathered, and who gathers it, and how it gets gathered, and all those pieces of that part of the puzzle, the back office or whatever you want to call it, just the basic creation of the product, is most interesting to me. The distribution is another problem that any business faces, or any enterprise, whether it's profit-making or nonprofit. And whether or not one particular form survives or how it survives is less important to me than the necessity to gather and process information that's important to the community as you define the community and as you define important.
You know, one of the questions I have as the total volume continues to expand is what endures. In this case, I mean, and by this I mean credibility. Sometimes I wonder if the matter of credibility of the individual doing the reporting becomes almost more critical as information becomes more diffuse, more volume.
I don't know if it's more or less. I think it is, you use the word endures, and I think it's enduringly important to have a certain conviction that facts matter and that explaining things clearly is important and useful, and that there's a certain place for what I would define as integrity in the sense of being clear about what you're doing and owning up to mistakes. And then trying to correct them and move on so that there's a record. Those things, if you want to say they endure, and yet news doesn't endure because news is just that first pass at what's going on. It endures now quite literally because, you know, who knows how the web is going to yellow and peel and, you know, how it's going to survive in terms of just archival materials. But let's assume that it is going to, that digital information has a life of its own. And it may or may not be useful. There's so much of it out there. But again, it is also searchable in a way that perhaps old forms of news, especially printed news, were not so easily. I don't worry so much, again, about those old verities, as much as I say, the things that I like about the news and doing it where you're accountable is that accountability, is the whole the idea that if you're going to say something, you ought to know what you're talking about to some degree. And where you don't really know what you're talking about, you ought to at least reveal that. That may not be a protocol that works very well with social media. And there's a conflict potentially there. And I don't know how you resolve that. And I don't know how it's going to be ultimately worked out. But in the meantime, you're on the side of saying, hey, let's get the story right. Let's look at things we think are important and tell people why we think they're important and see if they agree. And there's a real test in that in the market.
So the paper's going into its fifth year. I imagine at this point you have a sense of how the community feels about it. Do people approach you on the street or in the coffee shop to tell you how they feel?
They do. We get positive feedback, but then again, that's what people are likely to give you when they see you on the street. You know, although that's not always the case. Sometimes they read me out and they say, yeah, I didn't agree with you or whatever. And then we get that in letters. People take us to task, and that's great. I love to have letters that criticize us wrongly or rightly. It doesn't matter because that says people care about the newspaper. And one of the things that you find, especially with an older demographic, is that you do have that passion about a newspaper and the expectations that the newspaper will deliver the accurate information. And if that expectation isn't met, then you get people who are disappointed. And if they don't want to be disappointed. They want to have not necessarily themselves reflected back, but what they can see for themselves is true in the community. So that if you ignore something or if you get a fact wrong, those things are noticed. And people react. And that I find tremendously rewarding because it says that, again, people care about what's being said. And they've taken the time to read it and process that information in a way that they've found important enough to them, to themselves and their neighbors or whatever, to comment on it. And the other thing we get is people demanding more of us and saying, why don't you do this? Or why don't you do that? Or I want you to cover this, or get me this story. Or, you know, you should be doing this, and I don't know why you're not. And they're a little upset about it. And they also challenge you and say, hey, if you know, I might buy your paper if you'd come and do some more about us. And because people also want their lives reflected. And the people who aren't necessarily so immersed in the digital world still want their lives reflected back at them, but they want it in a way that they can absorb it. And they're not going to absorb it from the web or from blogs or from social media. They're going to absorb it from this thing that you can put down and know that it's not watching you as well as you're watching it.
Now, the Columbia Paper website doesn't have moderated comments, and this isn't a community that would probably use those much, even if they existed. So I'm guessing you get a lot of paper letters and emails. Do you think the environment of comment threads and social media creates a kind of false urgency to react, and that can sometimes lead to some of the more vitriolic aspects of the so-called dialogue out there?
Well, there's an abandonment of reflection. Mm. And when you do that, you get the emotion of the moment. But whether or not that's of greater value or it contributes more or less to the discussion is up for everybody to decide for him or herself. From my perspective, one of the things that is rewarding about doing a newspaper is the enforced reflection or period in which you are supposed to be able to reflect. And that's one of the things about doing a weekly as opposed to a daily, because in a daily, you're really just running under a slightly different deadline from a blog or posting on some sort of news website. And in a weekly, like Time, and I don't compare our newspaper to Time, but I'm just saying that any publication like that, that commits to print, there is that ability to say, no, wait, let's think about this. And you don't have months to do it, and you're not waiting for the rider isn't out there or the coach to take it, you know, over the bumpy rutted roads with the horse team to the next one and pass it on so that a few months later it arrives at its destination, maybe, unless, you know, the British capture it or whatever along the way. This is a period that's understandable, but it's enough time to take a deep breath. And we take too few deep breaths in our breathless society, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about your Video Freaks days. With the advent of portable video cameras in the late 60s, you and many other people took up video with what I gather was a general sense that this technology in the hands of regular people would be a democratizing force. Whether you would use video for reportage or art or entertainment. As a member of that movement, I'm curious what you think of the YouTube world in which we now live.
Well, first of all, I think just like the video movement, as it developed early on anyway, moved very fast. And there were so many things converging. Cable was just getting started, and we ran a pirate broadcast station for a while. And there were just all sorts of technological advances going on, and we were looking for outlets to use, and the conventional ones were basically cut off. We were cut off from them, and probably with good reason from the standpoint of the networks and the other people who were in the broadcast business at that time. There's this whole business of, you know, where YouTube is at and whether it's the realization of what we were thinking about is moving so fast and changing so fast that I think there's no way to know whether it's reached any point where you can define it. It's a moving target. And I find it fascinating in the abstract. In the practical aspect of it, I think it's so overwhelmed already with the volume of information that it's very difficult for people to find new things without some avenue for those new things to be found. I think what people don't really understand when they talk about video for large groups of people, for the masses, I suppose, is that it's difficult to produce. I mean, you know that as a producer. Yeah. Yeah. And to get something that's consistently watchable, rather than just, you know, oh, your cat has done something really cute and athletic. Well, okay, that might catch on. And you don't know. The other things are serendipitous. They're, you know, it's good, bad, whatever, but it catches on, and there it is. But I think that to do it in any way that is consistent, nobody knows how to do that yet. And nobody knows how to leverage those tools, although Google is trying to figure out, and all the others are too, how to take the data, what they know about us, and then mesh that with what they think they can produce, which is a very different thing from what we were doing. Because we were saying, what can we produce that people might like? Because the avenues to reach people were so few. Now the avenues to reach people are limitless, basically. Right. And so the problem is coming from the other end. I'm not sure that's necessarily very healthy, but it is what's happening.
I look at events like Occupy or Tutter Square, and it's clear that video cameras in the hands of everyone can be a very powerful tool. They bring us a bird's eye view of events where we were not present and where mainstream news isn't necessarily present. Of course, there's always a danger that sometimes these videos lack context. But that aside, I can't help but think of your description in your book of filming the May Day protests in Washington in 1971. You had a view that I think a lot of people didn't have of those events.
Well, that's a discussion that continues to this day. The May Day tapes, which I was only a small part, they continue to be of certain level of fascination for people because, again, you're right, it was a documentation of an event that didn't have an outlet. I was actually interested in, even there, in creating an outlet, something that was a little different so that people could actually see what was going on who were there. Now we really have that. But whether or not Occupy Wall Street can sustain itself shouldn't be placed on the back of what happened on YouTube. And yet, but when you think about it, it was a movement that is the effect of which is yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. And whether it could be rekindled or whether it actually did have the effect that was desired, and maybe we're seeing that in the negotiations right now. Who knows? I don't claim to be a political scientist in any analysis of this, and yet I see that again. You had all these avenues for expression, and what it did through YouTube, I think, was it brought the other media in. Mm-hmm. It, as much as it brought individual viewers around the world in, it brought the mainstream media in. Okay. And they said, okay, this is hitting us from so many different sources on this one platform, right. YouTube or online video. We better pay attention to it rather than any one event.
Now we're just a short period after the terrible events in Newtown, Connecticut. And you wrote an editorial supporting new dialogue on gun control. I'm sure living in this community, as I do, you have. Now, of course, the terrible events in Newtown, Connecticut just happened. And you wrote an editorial supporting new dialogue on gun control. I'm sure, like me, living in this community, you have many friends and neighbors who are generally pro-gun and have been gun owners their whole lives. Did that cross your mind at all as you were writing your op-ed?
I think the enormity of this crime, the multiple murders, is such that you can't really go with anything but your reaction as what you believe is right. You can't tailor it to an audience if the stakes are so high. I'm a grandparent and I have children that age. Yep. who are the same age as those children murdered. And the thought that some deranged or whatever. You're tempted to call him evil, whatever, however you want to characterize the person who did this terrible thing, would have the tools, the agency to do that. And that is potentially, if not preventable, at least we could make it less likely that that would happen. Trumps for me any sort of, well, let's try to make a measured tone to all of this. And at the same time, the stridency is not going to win you any converts. Right. So in that sense, you try to mount an argument that says, this is a public health issue. This is not something that can be defended. Not having no gun controls can't be defended because on the basis of the First Amendment, Second Amendment, excuse me, the Second Amendment doesn't give you the right, or didn't give any of us the right, to make these weapons so easily available. Again, if you look at history, then you say, well, we were 1994 to 2004. We did not sink into tyranny, and people did not lose their right to bear arms just because we had an assault weapons ban, loosely defined, and bans on the large clips and things like that. And you say, well, okay, but if people are fact-free, and this takes us back to our original discussion.
Right.
If people are willing to live in a fact-free world, or a world where facts are simply conveniences rather than a starting point from
right.
which to talk, we are all steeped in misinformation. I mean, we live in a world of so much information that nobody can be right all the time. The question is, you have to be prepared to hear something that's contradictory and to weigh it and see if indeed it might change your views because you have new information. I find that exciting. I find that a lively way to live.
You know, and on that point, to borrow a phrase from a friend of mine, he'll call the web a great tool for epistemic closure. For any belief you have, no matter how harebrained it might be, you can find a website with a great looking logo that will support whatever you want to believe. And a corresponding argument I often hear, because I wade into copyright issues quite frequently, is that intellectual property protections are somehow stopping people from accessing good information. And one example I often use is, well, you know, let's look at Darwin. Darwin's been in the public domain and widely available for all of our lives. Why are we still arguing about evolution in America in the 21st century? I think that just because the information's out there doesn't mean people necessarily seek it out. I don't know if you have anything to add on that.
Well, the one thing I would add to it is simply that there are institutions in society that allow us to have access to information that is mediated in ways that are really responsive to the community in a practical sense. And what I'm thinking about specifically is libraries.
Mm.
And the role of libraries, of course, changes as more information is digitized. But that's why library specialists have a degree usually in library and information science or some variation on that term. Because you need people to sort through this. But it's not as if copyright-protected information is not available. I'm more interested about in secrecy, a government secrecy, and the concerns that I have that are things that are there, and even industrial secrecy where it's keeping things that should be in the public domain secret. The hiding of information is of greater concern to me as a journalist and as a citizen than this volume of information and the fact that people might be deprived of all uses of information or certain types of use of information because it's copyrighted or the intellectual property is protected. I think you can enjoy, you have the right to enjoy it. You have the right to enlighten yourself. And you don't have to spend a penny out of your pocket. You can go to the library. And that library, there's somebody there in most cases who is knowledgeable enough to direct you to good information. And you don't have to be a student to get that service. That service is available. I've spent a lot of time over the years working with libraries, and I believe that they are now more relevant than they've ever been, even though they probably need less space for the storage of information and more space for people to sit down and have the time to think about what they really want to know.
More relevant because of what you just said?
Yeah, more relevant because how do you sift through this information? How do you find it? You can ask a friend, but if you want a neutral party, there is an institution in society that is set up specifically for that purpose. That's the public library. And people say, oh, but that's irrelevant now. You know, I have Kindle. I don't need a library. Unless you need a fact that you don't know how to get. And you can Google it, but you don't know, just as you pointed out, whether the scientific evidence or whatever kind of evidence that you're getting is actually really substantial or accurate or in any way helpful to what you're really looking for. And there is a resource. We underfund libraries, but libraries, which are basically our last bastion against being inundated by information that we can't sort through, we tend to marginalize them. And we do that at our peril.
And on the note of a plug for libraries, I'll thank you, Perry, for taking the time to talk to me today. Listeners can visit columbiapaper.com, or they can check out Perry's book about his days in the video movement, Video Freaks, America's First Pirate TV Station, and the Catskills Collective that turned it on. Thanks for listening.